Members know.
The Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement will come to order. This is the second day of our two-day agenda, September 12, 2013. And let's begin. Our topic today is post-retirement adjustment mechanisms. And we have the staff memo to start out with. Mr. Burrick.
Morning for you.
Members, the second consideration memo for post-retirement adjustment mechanisms is in your packet. Let me mention a few things before I start. One is that in both the first consideration memo and in the second consideration memo, I've referred to our commission principles, and we've gotten a few questions as to just where they are. The commission principles are, you have a copy of them in your packet. Within the packet, there's a folder that says standard packet items, commission rules, principles, valuation data, and various other items. You should have a copy of the commission principles in that sub-packet, and it's printed on pink paper to help you locate it. What I did for this second consideration memo was to try to see what was going on in other states. I took a look at some of the more recent changes in post-retirement adjustment procedures that are being used throughout the country. What I relied on was legislative session summaries compiled by the National Conference of State Legislatures, NCSL. Another thing I should mention is that I went back to 2001, basically studied those summaries from 2001 through 2012. And I should mention that in the earlier years of this period, there were virtually no changes in post-retirement adjustment procedures in any of the states, other than maybe one or two minor cleanups. It isn't until 2008 that we started to see a lot of activity. And that, of course, was due to the Great Recession that started in 2008, the impact that that had on the asset value of the pension funds. And a lot of the changes that I'll discuss here that we see throughout the country are a reaction to that situation. And I doubt very much that a lot of the procedures that I cover here are viewed by any of the particular states as certainly not the best policy for post-retirement, maybe not even a particularly good policy for post-retirement adjustments. But it was something that they felt needed to be done, at least in the short term. So I wouldn't be surprised to see various changes in the future as the situation continues to resolve itself. In reviewing those NCSL summaries, I put together a description of various post-retirement procedures. There are 18 of them all told, covered in this memo. And the first one is that I mentioned is something that the Louisiana legislature passed. This was in 2009. And perhaps this one shouldn't even be in the memo because it's not a true COLA in any form. It's not a true cost of living adjustment. It's really simply an optional annuity form, basically an actuarial equivalent optional annuity form, having the same value as the benefit without any adjustments applied to it. So since it's not really increasing the purchasing power of retirees in retirement to keep them anywhere near whole, it's not a true adjustment. Basically, what's going on here, might as well use the example that I covered in the memo. You know, rather than an individual, say, receiving a fixed $1,000 per month for life, What's going on under this self-funded cost of living adjustment is that the individual will receive a lot less than $1,000 initially, but that will be increased by 2.5% per year. At some point, the individual is going to get back to a $1,000 benefit that they would have had anyway, and it will continue to escalate afterwards, so that in the later years of retirement, the benefit's going to be more than $1,000. And basically the amount that the individual sacrificed in the earlier years, they'll gain back in the later years, but there's really no net gain to the individual whatsoever. So to the extent that this is not a true cost of living adjustment, it is totally inconsistent with the principle that we have in our principles of pension policy statement, which says that benefits during retirement should be adjusted in order to keep the individual whole, basically by adjusting those benefits during retirement as needed, given the inflation rate. So moving on to the second item. There were a few states that have delayed the first post-retirement adjustment. And again, I strongly suspect that this is an effort to try to reduce liability somewhat, but it is at the expense of good post-retirement policy. The last meeting we had, I mentioned that in Minnesota here with the Para Police and Fire Plan, there will be a three-year wait for individuals to receive a full post-retirement adjustment. And in a certain Ohio plan, for individuals who retire after 2014, the individuals must wait 5 years before they would receive any sort of post-retirement adjustment. A delay of that length of time is definitely going to harm the retirees, particularly if inflation is high. There will be a considerable loss of purchasing power before the individuals ever receive that first adjustment. So this long delays don't reflect good policy, at least certainly if the standard that we're using is the commission's statement of keeping individuals whole during retirement. So this approach is not certainly not consistent with our principal statement. The next item I cover, number three, is investment performance-based adjustments. And this approaches that fall into this category were recently enacted in Maryland, Louisiana, Rhode Island. And in the past, we've used them in Minnesota, particularly with the first-class city teacher plans. We discussed this at some length last time, so I won't go into much detail here. Basically, these are procedures where some sort of investment-based trigger might be used to declare that a distribution to retirees should be made, or some notion of excess return, investment return above and beyond the actual requirements can then be distributed to the retirees. As we've covered, Minnesota has used these in the past, and it was recognized that they weren't working well for the retirees in that they weren't producing adjustments that in any way, shape, or form matched inflation. Sometimes it was too high, sometimes it was too low. Because it's based solely on the return and without paying attention to whether the assets are actually there to back up these adjustments, they were very harmful to the pension plans. So in addition to the general harm that these approaches can have for a pension plan, because the adjustments are not at all consistent with inflation, this approach is not consistent with our policy statement. Next item I mentioned, this is number four, actuarial reserve-based adjustments. I'm not sure if any plan across the country is currently using this. I put it in here because it's closely related to number three, and it's an approach that we've used in the past in Minnesota. This was basically the approach that was used by the SBI invested plans. It's similar to the investment performance-based approach, but at least this one was based on reserves. If the actual assets weren't there to support increases, no investment-based adjustments were provided. So it at least had a shutoff valve, but it again had the same failing that in some years, some periods, it provided increases to retirees that were considerably above inflation. At other times, they may have fell behind. So that approach is, again, not consistent with our commission principles. Number five, this is reduced benefit multiplier, and benefit multiplier is also known as the accrual rate, in exchange for higher cost of living adjustments. And Kansas is the state that tried this, at least with one of its plans. This really doesn't seem to be getting anywhere. You're reducing the benefits at retirement. That would presumably lessen plan liabilities in exchange for higher benefits during retirement, which is going to increase those liabilities somewhat. So in all likelihood, is pretty much of a trade-off. Now, whether it's consistent with the policy statement really depends on what the situation was before this new procedure was put in place and the specific nature of the new procedure. What our policy statement says is that, at least for long-term public employees, when they retire, the benefit at retirement should be adequate, sufficient to keep them from having any significant loss in their standard of living. And second, the post-retirement adjustment policy statement says that those benefits should remain whole during retirement by providing adjustments matching inflation.
Madam Chair?
Is that a good one?
Mr. Burke, I'm just wondering what the difference is between number one and number five.
Number five. Yes. For anyone who elects it, they may well be fairly comparable, but number five is a system-wide change, whereas number one was simply being offered on an individual basis. People could elect it if they so desired. Okay. And maybe there was some reason why individuals may have preferred this self-funded cost of living adjustment, number one. I'm just speculating, but maybe something about the tax situation, the individual, they may have high income now. It's expected to be lower later, so perhaps they didn't mind reducing their current benefit in exchange for a higher benefit later on.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
There are a lot of similarities.
Hey, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Burke, you mentioned something about their retirement benefit should be adequate. Can you something about it should be adequate? And I'm just looking at our principles.
Right.
And number seven, adequacy of benefits at retirement. Can you explain what is adequate at the time of retirement? I mean, that there seems to be a big question mark. What is adequate?
Well, there's no specific number that I think
years of service in high five.
Right. No specific number that I can point to. Generally, the standard that we've used is that if an individual has at least 30 years of service, then the retirement benefit provided to that individual should be sufficient to not cause a noticeable loss in the standard of living.
Should include Social Security.
Right, including Social Security, including a reasonable amount of personal savings being used. Many, many years ago, it was probably the first year that I came on board, maybe the second year, back in 1990, there was a huge study that the commission actuary provided to us at that time, reviewing many, many situations, many, many different plans. And an estimate of what was reasonable and adequate varies on the plan and the situation and so on. You know, you have some plans where the individual has Social Security coverage, the coordinated plans. You have other, we have other plans where the individual is not covered by Social Security for the covered public employment. That would be the Parapolice and Fire Plan and the MSRS State Patrol Plan. Mm-hmm. So depending on the situation and the age that individuals are retiring and whether they have Social Security or not, you get a lot of different results for what is deemed to be adequate. That's why, for instance, for our coordinated plans, we have an accrual rate of 1.7 in many of them, 1.9, at least for newer service and some of the teacher plans, much higher accrual rates in the public safety plans, because in the public safety plans, individuals are going to be retiring earlier. So there's a need to build up a much higher benefit at an earlier age, and those individuals are not going to have Social Security coverage. So the accrual rates in the Parapolice and Fire and the State Patrol plan are 3% instead of the 1.7 or 1.9 that we have in the coordinated plans. So the plans are basically structured to provide that adequate benefit, provided the individual provides long service, approximately 30 years.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It just seems that we're going through some of these options and what's happened in other states, and there is a big question about what's adequate. And I don't know if we've ever really looked at that in this pension commission. And that's just, I'm just stating that is, if that's a comment that's being made, why we can't use some of these possibilities that have occurred in other states, then I think we need to take a good hard look at what is adequate and appropriate for the retirees going forward, because there's obviously going to have to be some adjustments, but.
All right, thank you for your comments. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Burke, maybe you can for the commission's benefit, talk about that 30-year employee who would have had what percentage of their public wages would have been transferred or how that would work into a pension benefit and what percentage of their income that they might have from that or from that in Social Security, just so that the commission gets an idea. If an employee retires making $50,000, they would be looking at what percentage of that $50,000 for retirement benefit from PERA, let's say, and then how would that coordinate with Social Security? Because you also said the other component would be adequate individual savings for us to be able to try to get kind of an idea of what percentage of a retiree's income would come from a state pension.
Replace much for the higher wage earners.
Right. Well, I can't give you a very detailed answer, but if we used a $50,000 high five and we assumed a 1.7% multiplier, the individual would receive approximately 51% of that $50,000 high five, or a little bit over $25,000 a year. That would be the benefit from the retirement plan, assuming the individual retires at normal retirement age. If the individual retired somewhat earlier, the benefit would be could be less because the individual might have less years of service. And if they had 30 years of service, there might be a reduction for early retirement.
And that's before taxes, so that would be taxable.
Right.
Social Security.
Yeah. And then you'd have to add Social Security to that, and I don't have a real good feel for what that would be.
If that person was paying into an employment plan, are they also paying into Social Security too? So they're eligible
yes.
for that?
Yes. Anyone who has a 1.7% multiplier is in a plan with a 1.7% or 1.9% multiplier is covered by Social Security for that employment as well.
Madam Chair, follow up if I could.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you. And then about what percentage of their income on that $55,000 might be made up with Social Security benefits, assuming that they retired at the normal retirement age? That's the thesis that we're working under right now. Would they see another 25% or 30% or the other 50% of lost wages?
Madam Chair, if I can jump in at this point. I can't give you it in straight percentages for the example that Mr. Burek used of 50,000, although 50,000 is a little less than half, somewhat less than half of the current Social Security maximum taxable wage. Social Security really breaks out into three levels of our replacement of income. The bottom tier is about 85%. The middle tier is, if my memory serves me right, 45%, and at the top end of wage, 15%. So this person is going to look more like it's going to be a composite of more of the 85% of the first tier and about 45% of the second tier, and very little of the 15%. Without trying to translate that, one could easily, there are Social Security calculators online where one can plug in a salary level and get a Social Security benefit fairly quickly. But the formula is somewhat complicated, and doing it on the fly is probably going to give you the wrong answer, which is probably worse than giving you a somewhat half-baked answer that I'm giving you now.
And I'm not looking for the specific math. Thank you, Madam Chair. What I'm wanting to have the commission understand is that when an individual retires, about 50% of their current earnings are going to be made up by pension benefits. There's going to be Social Security, and let's just for argument's sake say it's 25%. The other 25% is what an individual would have to do in managing their individual budget, work years versus non-work years, or in savings that they would have accumulated otherwise. And we're talking about making an adjustment. And from the testimony that we've heard thus far in the commission about adjustments and benefits and post-COLAs and those types of things, I think the commission needs to keep in mind that we can't be looking at the PERA or the public pension portion of this making up the entire balance for the $55,000 wage that they would have earned, that personal savings is going to be something that the individual is going to have to look at. There's the federal government component and whatever they do with Social Security, and then there's the other component that we do. So for us to say, have someone come to us and say, it cost me $2,000 more a year to live this year than it did last year, therefore my state pension needs to go up by $2,000, I would say that that's failed logic, because not 100% of your income is coming in post-retirement from a state pension. And so I think it's very important that we look at that being a portion of the assets available to a retiree and not the 100% of the asset pool that's available when we're talking about these types of things as well.
I think when we're talking about adequacy, too, we look at the lifestyle of a retiree, that they don't have child care expenses, they don't have college expenses, hopefully, and they for their children, and they're likely they've paid off their mortgage. So, and they are, probably don't need work clothes, for example, so that their expenses should be less. On the other hand, they typically have more medical expenses that that they have to pay out.
Should cover some.
Any other comments? So we'll have Mr. Burke continue.
Getting back to number five, and that's the reduced benefit multiplier in exchange for higher cost of living adjustments. Where this falls out depends on what the situation was before and what the specific situation is after these particular changes. It's possible that this approach could be consistent with the principles if the benefit multiplier before this change was excessive. So if this reduction brings it back to the point where we can say, okay, the benefit is adequate at retirement, and if these higher cost of living adjustments happen to match inflation, then it would be consistent. But there's a wide range of possibilities here. Moving on to number six, this one is for currently active employees. Post-retirement adjustment is eliminated in exchange for a higher benefit multiplier, higher accrual rate. In this approach, and
Kansas did this again.
Yeah, it's
like the opposite.
Kansas really seems to be in turmoil, and it's doing some very different things, totally different approaches in the different plans. There doesn't seem to be any consistency. Anyway, for one of its plans or a few of its plans, currently active employees will get a higher accrual rate, so the benefit when they do retire is going to be higher, but they will have no post-retirement adjustments at all. This approach is certainly not consistent with the notion that retirees should be kept whole during retirement. You know, maybe the front loading is enough to eliminate harm, at least for a considerable amount of time. But at some point, these retirees are going to be hurting. Number seven is even more draconian. Here, the post-retirement adjustments are going to be eliminated entirely, without any increase in the current benefit multiplier. So this approach is certainly not consistent with commission principles. Number eight, post-retirement adjustments escalating with years in retirement. And I found this to be a rather odd system. What Nevada put in place for one or more of its plans is that they would have an ultimate level of post-retirement adjustment. And in their case, they are declaring that 4% is the ultimate level. And what they will do is when the individual retires, the individual will receive virtually no cost of living adjustment. And then it will be a little bit higher the year after that, a little bit higher the year after that. And it will continue to escalate over time. And this says 12 years. That might be a typo. I think it should be 14. The individual will eventually reach an annual increase from that point out, from there on after, of 4% each year. A problem with this approach is that at least an individual is retiring at about age 65. The individual would be in their late 70s or 80 before they may be getting post-retirement adjustments that could keep them whole. So there's likely to be considerable lost purchasing power in those early years. So I doubt very much that the ultimate 4% increase that they're going to get in their late 70s or 80s is going to be sufficient to in any way make up for the losses earlier. And the timing is certainly an issue. The retirees probably would have been a lot better off with higher adjustments earlier and more modest adjustments later so that they could have perhaps enjoyed that income more.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Burke, it would be maybe nice to at some point to have a chart or some discussion about the purchasing power too, how it is affected by a decrease or a stabilization on the retirees' benefits going forward, or specifically in the case of Nevada, where they're receiving a low increase on their annuities and the retirement. So I'm just trying to get a basis of how much it does affect the purchasing power. We've talked about that quite a bit too, and that's hard to gauge how greatly it's going to affect the economy.
Madam Chair, members, it's something I frankly should have provided. problem I have is that, you know, I live and breathe this stuff, and I have a
we do too,
very good internal sense for just what some of these numbers mean, and I forget that people who don't spend as much time with it could benefit from a graph.
Sam Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was being a little smug there. We breathe and eat this all the time, too, for this joke. But I also would like to have a comparison of states that are similar to Minnesota as far as number of retirees, their funds, their unfunded liability, if we can have a comparison. So we're looking at states that perhaps not even in the same ballpark as Minnesota. And maybe we can whittle down this information to what could possibly be more appropriate for our state.
Okay.
And I think, Madam Chair, the Pew Foundation also, I know we're going off of NCSL's information, but I believe the Pew Foundation has some really outstanding information, too, that we could perhaps gather from them, too.
Do we have any plans to have the Pew Foundation in or look at some of their work?
Madam Chair, it's something that we can pursue if you'd like. We anticipated this project would go for two meetings by the commission, but it could be expanded if it strikes a nerve, if it's something you want to pursue. We can
just in general the Pew Foundation's work on pensions. Mm-hmm. Are you looking at Senator Rosen?
Well, they have specifically earmarked some of the more aggressive, successful states on pension reform. I'd like to see what they have in comparison. So we have.
Don't they advocate more of hybrid approaches?
They have been looking at Madam Chair, I'm sorry, excuse me. The seminar I went to in D.C. a couple years ago, they brought in some experts from states that were doing hybrids. Mm-hmm. And it would be nice to have a summary of what their conclusions are, because I do think that's something we need to seriously look at.
Okay. When we look at hybrids, we should include their work.
Mm-hmm. And I might do some little work on my own just to see what they are concentrating on at this point, too, Madam Chair.
Members,
Mr. Burke.
Number 9 and 10 are actually the same. 9 I labeled increases capped by annual dollar amount, and 10 are adjustments on benefit amounts up to a specified dollar amount, and lower adjustments or no adjustments thereafter. The approaches are really one and the same. If you just consider a benefit level, $1,000, whatever it happens to be, if you, say, apply a 3% adjustment to that, the result is a dollar amount of a benefit increase. Well, certain states are using the as a measure the amount of the dollar increase. And for example, if a $500 cap was in place, any annual benefit adjustment up to that would not be constrained in any way. But if you happen to be above 500, it would be capped at 500. Well, you could also look at the benefit level that is creating the adjustment that is right at that cap. And you could declare that there will be no adjustments on any benefits above that level. It's really the same thing. It's just which side of it you want to look at. So to the extent that they're the same, any advantages or problems with these approaches are also identical.
So this is the retirees who are receiving a higher benefit than are capped in terms of their COLA?
Yes. And the problems with it are quite numerous, actually. The first is that, now maybe there's a lot more detail to this than is indicated in these summaries, but there doesn't seem to be any recognition of service credit in determining what an appropriate cap is. It is simply a benefit above a certain amount or an adjustment above a certain amount is going to be capped. And by ignoring service credit, it penalizes long service employees and would reward the short service employees. All the systems in Minnesota and elsewhere are going to pay a larger benefit the longer an individual is in service. I mean, in Minnesota, for instance, we go by high five average salary and the accrual rate and years of service. The accrual rate is the portion of the high five average salary that the individual receives for each year of service. And so the more years of service the individual has, the higher that overall benefit's going to be. Therefore, the longer the individual is in service, the more likely that person will be subject to a cap when they retire. So if this approach is implemented quite crudely, what it's going to do is it's going to leave all the short service individuals whole and penalize the long service individuals, which it just doesn't seem to be a logical approach. Another example, which frankly falls into this long service, short service situation, is the early retirees versus those who stay around to normal retirement age. For instance, we've had a lot of individuals retire under Rule of 90 or other subsidized early retirement provisions, and those provisions are subsidized. The individuals who retire early under those provisions receive a somewhat higher benefit than they would if an actual reduction was applied to it. So the individuals who are providing the longer service, staying around to normal retirement age, are currently providing a subsidy to the early retirees. If we were to place a cap on our Minnesota plans as well, again, the individuals who stay to normal retirement age, they have higher benefits, therefore they're going to have higher adjustments, therefore they are going to hit the cap, while some of the individuals who retired under the Rule of 90 wouldn't. Given that the individuals who are staying to normal retirement are already subsidizing that earlier group, placing a cap that impacted the individuals who stayed the longest would be adding salt to the wound. Another problem that would need to be addressed if we were to try to implement this in Minnesota is that there would have to be some recognition for the type of plan involved. Most individuals are covered by coordinated plans, but we do have some individuals, again, the Parapolice and Fire and the MSRS State Patrol Plan, which are basic plans. And those basic plans provide a much higher benefit because it is understood that the individuals don't have Social Security coverage for that public employment, and therefore the Minnesota plan needs to replace a far larger portion of income compared to individuals in coordinated plans who are also going to be getting Social Security in retirement. So if no adjustment is made for that plan type, what's going to happen is that the individuals in the police and fire plans are going to be subject to a cap, and it's a lot less likely that individuals in the coordinated plans would be. So if there was any effort to implement a cap, you might need to have a lower cap for the coordinated plans, a much higher cap in place for the basic plans, and you might have to fine-tune it even more than that. There would also be combined service issues. An individual with all their service in one plan might hit the cap. An individual who has service in two plans is going to receive somewhat lesser benefits from each of those plans, but add the two together and it could be comparable to the first individual. But if, again, this wasn't carefully constructed, what could happen is the individual who has service in the two plans would sail under the cap, whereas the individual with all the service in one plan would wind up being subject to the cap. So maybe it's possible to pick up individuals with combined service annuities. Maybe it's possible to pick up individuals who have service in several plans who don't use the combined service annuity. But it would certainly be another layer of administrative complexity. There would also be a need to be cognizant of the annuity forms. Individuals in any of our plans can take a straight life annuity. Straight life annuity covers solely the individual, that particular retiree, and a straight life annuity pays the highest benefit, highest monthly benefit of any of the forms. Individuals, though, could also take a joint and survivor annuity to cover a spouse. Those joint and survivor annuities are supposed to be actuarial equivalent, and therefore the individual takes a reduction in the monthly benefit in order to provide the continuing coverage to the spouse, for example, when the retiree dies. You could run into situations where, again, if you don't pay careful attention to the annuity forms, where the individual who takes the straight life annuity hits the cap, the individual who takes a joint and survivor annuity doesn't, because the joint and survivor annuity is paying a slightly lower monthly benefit. There would also be a need to try to figure out how to apply this to Social Security leveling option annuities. Members may recall that this last legislative session, legislation was passed eliminating the Social Security leveling option annuity for the para plans. There was discussion about whether to do that for the teacher plans as well, but the teacher plans wanted to retain it. So we do still have that type of annuity out there. And what that Social Security leveling option does is it was intended to be used for individuals who retire early before Social Security benefits would kick in. And it would what it would do is it would front load the benefit from the Minnesota plan. So for the early years, the individual would receive a much higher benefit. And then when Social Security kicked in, the individual starts receiving income from Social Security, the benefit from the Minnesota plan goes way down. So basically, and the reduction in those later years has to be sufficient to compensate the plan for that escalated payout in the early years. Well, again, with the cap, you could have situations where, because of the early years of the plan, when the Minnesota pension plan is paying out a very high amount, the individual could hit the cap. Whereas if they'd taken hadn't taken this option, they might not. So some thought would have to be given to whether to do anything with that option or not. So it's an approach that has problems, and it would be, while it seems very simple in concept, it could be difficult in practice to implement in a way that would seem to be fair. Now, regarding consistency with our principles, to the extent that a post-retirement adjustment is capped, it's clearly not consistent with the principle, because the cap would prohibit the individual from being made whole, even if the general system in place were to provide inflation matching adjustments. So I mentioned that item 10 here is exactly the same as 9. It's just looking at the other side of the coin. So anything I said about the approach in 9 would also apply to 10. Moving on to number 11, there is an Ohio public safety plan where the Ohio legislature revised its laws so that individuals would receive a full 3% fixed post-retirement adjustment only if the person's benefit from the Ohio plan was less than 175% of the poverty level. Presumably, individuals above that level would be receiving some sort of benefit adjustments, but it would be for a lesser amount. So it would be only the people falling below that 175% of the poverty level threshold where they would receive a full adjustment.
So somehow they would have to submit their tax reports?
I would assume so. There would be some system for monitoring it.
Okay.
The problems with this approach are fairly similar to the earlier two approaches that I mentioned. Again, if Minnesota were to consider trying to implement this on a sort of broad scale, you'd have to pay attention to whether a plan is a basic plan or a coordinated plan. The coordinated plan is going to pay much lower benefits. If you were to use the same threshold, you might have many members of coordinated plans who would fall below that level. It's less likely if the individuals are covered by a basic plan because the basic plan is paying a higher benefit. So you might need to have different thresholds for different plans. And again, there's this service credit issue that seems to be ignored here. Maybe an individual is getting a low benefit and therefore they fall below this threshold, but we have to ask, why is the benefit low? Well, the benefit might be low because the individual didn't provide much Minnesota public service, and therefore they have a low benefit from the Minnesota plan. It doesn't seem to make sense to make an effort to keep those individuals whole while the individuals who provided longer public service and therefore have higher benefits would not be kept whole. So there's a lot of fairness issues.
And a good one.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Berg, I'm just looking at that and thinking they might have other retirement income besides this, too.
Yes.
And they
yes.
might be have been a part-time or seasonal worker that got benefits, but only for that amount.
Yes.
So the only way that would make sense to do that would be if you considered their entire income, not
right.
just the income
well,
from
I
that
think
retirement
this would have
plan.
To look at their entire income.
Yeah.
Or was
well,
it, is
it
just looking at their entire retirement
it just
income?
It just looks at their pension benefit for that pension plan.
Right. They may have other
yeah.
income.
And they,
I was saying the tax forms, that would be another way to look at this as an anti-poverty
right.
COLA, is if you looked at their entire income.
Correct. Yeah.
Again, because this approach is treating different groups of retirees in different manners, it's not an approach that's consistent with your principal statement because it's certainly not designed to keep all the retirees whole. Number 12 is either no adjustments up to a specified age or non-compounded adjustments, which is actually pretty similar to having no adjustments. Louisiana, given some legislation that recently passed there, will provide no adjustment to anyone who is retired but is younger than age 60. Illinois has some really severe problems with their pension plans. Illinois recently revised its law so that it will provide no adjustments, at least in certain plans, prior to age 67. And Mississippi has this non-compounding increase prior to age 55, which is very similar to actually the Louisiana or Illinois approach, except it's using a different age. In Mississippi, for instance, if we assume there was some 3% adjustment in place and the individual's receiving $1,000 a month, basically instead of $1,000, the individual would be given $1,030. But then the next year, it doesn't compound. It's not added to the base. So the next year, the individual is again receiving $1,030 per month, and same the year after that and year after that, until the individual finally hit age 55, and then it would begin to compound. So then it would be $1,030 and then $1,061 and so on. Again, this seems designed to try to reduce liabilities in the plan, but it harms the retirees. You have groups of retirees who are simply not being kept whole because in the early years of their retirement, they're either receiving inadequate adjustments because of the lack of any compounding or no adjustments at all. Perhaps part of the motivation here was an effort to discourage early retirement by indicating that, look, you can retire, but if you do retire, we're not going to adjust your benefit until you're much further along in life.
And we do have penalties in place for early retirement in other ways. In Minnesota, for example, you have a lower benefit, right?
Well, you have a lower benefit because the individual is has provided less years of service. But in Minnesota, a lot of the early retirements are subsidized.
It's not the full actuarial value.
Yes, not the full actuarial value. Anyone who retired under the rule of 90, for instance, it's a subsidized benefit. So what I was going to say is that to the extent that the approach that I'm discussing here under number 12 is an effort to discourage early retirement, a far more straightforward way to do that would be to simply revise the early retirement ages for the plan and to eliminate any subsidies in the existing laws for early retirement. Now, if you want to discourage it, then don't encourage it by subsidizing it. Moving on to 13, there are a few, well, one state it looks like, Maryland judges' plan and the legislators' plan. They put in place post-retirement adjustments matching the rate of salary increase for active plan members. And this type of approach was actually very common in Minnesota. It was used in the local police and paid fire plans as the mechanism, often the only mechanism, or at least the primary mechanism, for adjusting the benefits for the retirees. Basically, under this approach, the retirees would get an increase in their benefits equal to whatever the percentage increase was in active duty salaries. How well this works, given our standard, depends on the nature of the salary increases relative to inflation. If the salary increases are doing no more than matching inflation, then it would work reasonably well. To the extent that salary increases are capturing a reward for higher skill, higher knowledge, because people have been around longer, they're more valuable to the employer, then that could result in increases to the retirees that would be considerably in excess of inflation. I'm not sure how well this works will work in Maryland for the judges and the legislators. In Minnesota, though, the salaries of judges tends to be unchanged for very long periods of time. Salaries of legislators tends to be unchanged for very long periods of time. So it could be very detrimental to retirees to try pegging their benefit increases to any salary increases for Minnesota judges or Minnesota legislators.
We don't have that currently in place in Minnesota?
No. No. I should comment a bit on problems that occurred when this system was used for the local police and fire plans. When this was being used, what usually occurred was the increase for retirees was tied to a very specific position, that of a top-grade patrol officer, top-grade firefighter. And that created problems. There was a little too much intertwining of policies for active employees versus the retirees, because whatever happened to be granted as the increase for that specific position, top grade patrol officer or firefighter, would drive the pension plan liabilities because it would in turn specify the increase for the retirees. And there was also problems because of incentives it would create to build additional salary into that particular position. For instance, if it's fairly standard that a police officer is going to put in a certain amount of overtime, then it would not be unreasonable to say that, well, the salary of a top-grade patrol officer for purposes of the pension plan should include that particular amount of overtime pay. But then there could be arguments about, well, maybe we should increase that portion. If you increase that portion, that results in a higher percentage increase for the retirees. And there are also issues of to the extent that shift differentials should be included in this, clothing allowances, allowances for canines, et cetera. Anytime a new element was added to that, that would increase the salary and therefore would increase the percentage increase compared to the prior salary and would increase the benefit to the retirees. So it could create a lot of incentives that aren't necessarily constructive. And it could be somewhat difficult for all plan groups to decide just what position or a class of employees to use to base the salary increase driven post-retirement adjustment. So it's an approach that it has been used. Minnesota has largely abandoned it at this point. Number 14 is a fixed percentage increase, and this may eventually be in place after Minnesota transition through various levels of funding ratio triggers. We discussed that at the last meeting. And it had been in place for a few years just prior to the 2010 financial sustainability provisions. A fixed percentage increase is a rather blunt tool, but on average, it might be consistent with the Commission's pension principles if that fixed percentage increase did happen to be equal to the long-run rate of inflation. Inflation, of course, is going to be high in some years, very low in other years, and there's some average there. But if you gave individuals a fixed percentage increase equal to perhaps the estimate of what the long-term rate of inflation was, on average it might be right. Some years individuals will be undercompensated, some years overcompensated, but hopefully on average it would work. There would be some noise around this, though. Everything would depend on the specific cohort and the experience of that cohort as that group would move towards retirement. So while not ideal, it might be a reasonable and practical way to go. Number 15 is lower percentage adjustments or no adjustments to be increased when certain funding ratios are met. This we discussed last time, so we don't need to go into it in any great detail. Apparently, it's also being tried in Arizona, New Jersey, Rhode Island, South Dakota, and possibly a few other places. What can be said about this is that it's placing the funding situation, funding condition of the plan on the front burner, saying that post-retirement adjustments will have to go on the back burner at least for a while. So while it's not ideal, it may be a reasonable approach to the situation that Minnesota was in. 16 is a blink-on procedure. If a funding ratio, for instance, falls below a particular target, post-retirement adjustments would be halted. If the ratio goes back above, post-retirement adjustments are started again. And This is in law right now for Minneapolis teachers, not Minneapolis teachers, Duluth teachers. When it and if the fund eventually reaches a 90% funding ratio, then this mechanism would come into play. Duluth teachers would pay a 5% inflation match, but if they drop below 90%, there would be no adjustment whatsoever. They go back above 90%, then the inflation match would again occur.
Mr. Burke, I was just wondering, during the years when we gave COLAs in excess of inflation, was that during the 90s? Would we still have retirees in the system who had experienced that, you know, above inflation increases? Or do you think most of them have passed?
I'm sure we still have a lot of retirees in the system who lived through those years.
Because since it's compounded, they've got that those extra dollars.
Yeah. The 90s were excellent years. Well, excellent in terms of the amount of post-retirement adjustments that were provided. They were excessive inflation, greatly in excess of inflation. I recall that discussions, presentations that we had a few years ago where we looked at that period, and individuals who retired in 1990, by the time 2000 came around, their benefits had doubled. Which was far and above what was needed to keep them whole with inflation. And, you know, individuals who retired in the 1990s, they've been retired 20, 25 years.
Madam Chair.
So some of them are still around.
To your point, and what Mr. Burke was saying earlier, we will have that in the system for a while because I would suspect that a number of the pension recipients had taken joint and survivor annuity options, and so that survivor option still has that built in, even though the covered employee may have passed. So it's going to be in the system for a while.
And if they retired early at 55 or 60 even, and people are living longer.
Mm-hmm. So as I say, I believe we'll have that in the system for quite a while, to your point.
I think what would be interesting is if we went back, I don't know how many years, you went back to 78 here and did kind of a comparison. If we had only done the rate of inflation, comparing that to what we actually did in terms of COLAs, that would be a useful comparison, perhaps.
Before 1978, Madam Chair, there were very few increases. There were a couple in 72, 73, by and large, we didn't have any.
Don't go back that far. Only go back to where we think there might still be people in the system, in maybe 20 years or 25 years. If people retired at 55.
30 years.
Maybe 30 years,
They still be a young person.
30 years in retirement, right.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Burke.
The adjustments in that period, for instance, they cover all the SBI invested plans, so some of those would be the police and fire plans, and some of those individuals were retiring at 50, 55.
Right.
And as has been pointed out, there's the joint and survivor effect.
Is this in our packets? There is a comparison in our packets. If we go back, for example, there are some years where it matched pretty closely, like inflation was in 1990, inflation was 4.8, and the, at least if we just take the MSRS plan, was 4%. In 91, 5.2 inflation, the MSRS plan is 5.1%. So there are some years where it matches, and then when you get to 93, inflation was 2.9 and the COLA was 4.5. 94, it was 2.8 and the COLA was 6. 96, it was 2.9, the COLA was 6.3. So there are just a number of years throughout the 90s where with very high COLAs up until 2002. Yeah, they're looking at that too. So maybe over the long term, you know, even though we've been freezing COLAs the past couple of years or had very low COLA rates, also the inflation has been fairly low. The last few years. So we probably still have overpaid COLAs still in the system.
I understand.
Okay, Mr. Burke, continue on. You're still on 16?
I'm pretty well done with. Well, I suppose I should mention on 16. Specific to our Duluth plan, if and when this 5% inflation match ever does become effective, the approach would not be ideal, one, because it's capped, and second, because of this blink-on, blink-off procedures. If individuals are kept whole in some years and giving nothing in another year because the funding ratio dipped below 90, then the individuals are not going to be kept whole in the longer term. And there is no catch-up provision in that law that says, well, if you didn't pay it this year, but it looks like we could pay it next year, maybe we can give you what you are owed this year plus compensate you for
the prior
year.
Advantage to looking back 20 years, though, is because those high inflation rates have compounded, you may have a situation where even though if you were to freeze COLA rates, for those of retirees at any rate, the purchasing power is still intact because of the compounding of their of the inflation. So, you know, I think it's more complicated than just looking year by year. Okay.
Members, I can't remember exactly how many years ago, maybe about 10 years ago now, I did do an analysis where I looked at this cohort by cohort. You know, suppose you had individuals who retired in 1980. Were they kept whole? How about they retired in 81? Were they kept whole? Mm-hmm. And the analysis is pretty interesting. You had some groups that were receiving benefits much higher than needed to keep them whole, but there were an awful lot of groups who had fallen way behind. It just depended on when they happened to retire. Mm-hmm. Some groups who went through the 90s, for instance, despite the very large increases during the 90s, weren't actually whole because they hadn't maybe retired a decade before then. And their experience during the 80s put them so far behind that despite what happened in the 90s, they were still not made whole. So you wound up with very unique results cohort by cohort, where some were whole and others were not.
Well, I could see that if you go back to 79, the inflation was 7.7%. There was no COLA with MSRS. In 1980, inflation was 11.4, no COLA. In 81, inflation was 13.4, 3.2 COLA. So there were a number of years in the 80s where, for whatever reason, there were no COLAs or very low COLAs.
Yes, and going through that experience, that group would have gotten so far behind that even when the 90s hit and they got very sizable adjustments, it still wasn't enough to bring them up all the way. Moving on to 17, capped inflation match, and this is being used in, it's on the books anyway for some Minnesota plans. Hasn't phased in yet, specifically the St. Paul teachers, Duluth teachers, and also the parapolice and fire plan will eventually have a very low capped inflation match. It's also being tried in Colorado, Connecticut, Hawaii, Illinois, and a few other states. It's a fairly commonly used approach, and we've discussed this a bit today and also last time we met. An inflation match would be an ideal approach. Once you cap that match, it's going to fall a little bit short because there are going to be years where the individuals are not kept whole. Now, something could be built into the system, sort of a catch-up provision, where individuals who weren't kept whole because they hit the cap in a later year or years could receive some sort of additional adjustment. Doing something like that is certainly possible. It might be administratively complex. And in the long term, might not be much different than simply a fixed percentage increase, where that fixed percentage increase was targeted on the long-term inflation rate. That might, in the long term, produce results that weren't that dissimilar to a capped inflation match in terms of keeping people whole. And it would certainly be easier to administer. You wouldn't have to keep track of individual by individual, cohort by cohort, which cohorts have fallen behind, which cohorts haven't, and figure out just how to adjust the benefits. Finally, I list here number 18, inflation match, apparently with no cap. And there are a few plans in Maryland, state patrol and correctional plans, and also plans in Vermont that apparently are trying this, an inflation match where it's apparently not capped in any way. And that approach would be fully consistent with the commission's principal statement. With those, I open up to any questions that any additional questions members may have.
Any questions from members?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Rosen.
There seems to be a lot of inconsistent with the commission's policies going forward on this. So I'm not sure when the last time the commission looked at their principles.
Mr. Martin?
Members, it was 2007 was the last time the commission mm-hmm. looked at the principles. Mm-hmm. We have as a interim project to look at the principles yet this interim. Matter of fact, the first time we will do that will be in October. And we're also in November starting to look at benefit plan design issues, which is also something you were concerned about earlier today. So those are still interim projects that will be undertaken before we're done.
Great. Thank you.
I thought Mr. Burke's comment on the compromise under number 17 was interesting, that with the capped inflation matches, it's a compromise between keeping retirees whole while maintaining the plan asset base, which, of course, is also in the benefit of for the benefit of retirees and future retirees. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to revisit one item, and I just did some quick math, and I definitely could be wrong, so I'm going to put that out there as a disclaimer on this. But I thought I had heard you say, Mr. Burke, that those who might have retired, now what I did is I used 1981 as the retirement date, and that 10-year cohort that would bring us up to 1990. And I saw cumulative non-compounded CPI of 53.7%. but COLA adjustments of 68.6%. So those folks probably would have, during that 10-year time period of the 80s, kept up on average over that 10-year period of time. And maybe I misheard you, or I'm not looking at the statistics correctly. I'm just looking at the green sheet here.
I think you'd probably have to go back a little farther than 81, because the high inflation years were in the late 70s, early 80s.
I very well may have been an error. It may have been individuals who retired in the later 70s.
Yeah, and that's why I just wanted clarification, because I used even 1981 in there because there was a 13.4% CPI and a benefit of 3.2, just to try to figure that average in there. And our chart doesn't go back prior to 1978 to be able to kind of do an analysis on that. But it would show that, we probably had some ramped up inflation in the latter parts of the 70s that led to the issues of the 80s. So,
if members, it would seem pertinent to provide you with a copy of Mr. Burek's memo from several years ago, and if it's easy enough to do, we'll try and update it so it's a little more current and provide that to you in the next week or so.
Thank you. That would be very helpful.
Representative Kahn.
Well, one of the statements that I kind of like the best is the one in 14 on page 6, the one near the end where it says, but a far more straightforward approach and one that will be more successful overall would be to create a pension that is adequate at the time of retirement and with post-retirement adjustments matching inflation. Then the question that I asked last week, which, again, the answer is we don't know, is the inflation rate correct for older people? When you look at the we discussed that a little bit today, too. We look at the things that they don't have to pay for, and when you look at the and then when you say, well, that's often offset by higher health care costs. But with the changes in now health care, is that going to change? So, you know, if you could take health care out of the equation, there's so many things in this country. If we could take health care out of the equation, life would be so much simpler as it is in other countries.
And then, of course, retirees have the Arizona home to support, too.
Is there anybody in this room?
The policy principles talk about adequacy at retirement and talk about adequacy after retirement.
Yeah.
And there are two different measures or two different notions there. Trying to get a fix on what's adequate at our retirement, our policy principles seem to use a replacement of pre-retirement income as the the measure. That if you replaced 70% of pre-retirement income, or 60%, or 80%, that's functionally the way we've seemed to have worked it. It's not clear that that is the optimal way to do things, folks. At retirement or during retirement, it seems that people have different levels or different patterns of spending money. The early retiree, the retiree during the early years of retirement, does things differently than the retiree towards the end of their retirement years. And it's not clear that replacement of a pre-retirement income is necessarily well patterned to match that. So we have issues about whether what adequacy at retirement really means.
Mm-hmm.
And then the problem you're talking about, the adequacy or deficiency of the cost of living as a measure for all kinds of economic, all kinds of folks in the general economy, whether that's a particularly good measure for retirees. And it has its limitations, obviously. The problem with it is, or the reason why it's utilized is there is no other measure that's generally accepted or generally utilized. So for lack of a better ruler, we use that ruler.
Okay.
Any other discussion from the commission? Just an FYI, the Harold Bickers replacement has been hired. His name is Mansco Perry.
Great.
And we don't know when his start date is, but we certainly will invite him to come visit the commission at the next commission meeting.
Yeah.
Mr. Fleming?
You probably all know that he was Howard's understudy for many years. Howard suffered under the salary cap. Mansco was paid so poorly. He always recruited and went east and came back to McAllister.
Representative Kahn.
Can we get a report on the McAllister's investment
plan?
And
maybe from Mr. Perry.
Madam Chair, that would have been a pre-hire requisite, I think.
Well, I think so. It might be too late.
Oh, no, we just, it's only just oversight to look at it at this point. I assume somebody did, but just.
Well, I know, you know, I've heard Hamlin has been in trouble, but I haven't heard anything about McAllister, so. Is there anybody in the audience who would like to share their perspectives on COLA, any of the members of the public, any of the plan directors? Anybody have any changes planned? All right, Mr. Merton, why don't you let us know what we're going to get done early, it looks like, today, what we have ahead. You mentioned October.
October members were doing the membership eligibility question with the ERA salary threshold and potentially other considerations having to do with plan membership. That's a continuation of something we did a month ago. We'll also be starting to look at the policy principles, trying to identify those areas since 2007 that seem to be inconsistent with our policies, legislative actions that may be inconsistent, raising the question, did we fall off the well-beaten path, mm-hmm. or is the path the wrong path? That's next month. We also have, at the moment, there was a bill that had to do with the Metropolitan Council and City of Minneapolis mm-hmm. and MRF division contributions. Mm-hmm. I'm talking with Minneapolis. They're talking with the Met Council. It's not clear whether that issue can be resolved other than legislatively. And we probably will have the have some information from the Pew Foundation on post-retirement adjustments as a follow-up. If we can get someone from Pew, we may be able to do that. Otherwise, we'll try and summarize mm-hmm. what information is generally available.
Okay, and then we're planning a November meeting?
We are planning on a November meeting. You have not yet set the date for the Great. November meeting.
Did we talk about doing a December meeting, or were we going to skip December?
We were going to do six meetings starting in August, so I suspect we're doing a December meeting.
What I thought we would do is an early December meeting and then a late January meeting, so we allow for people who have travel or vacation plans. And please let us know if you do have certain dates, specifically in December or January, that you want us not to schedule. That would be helpful. Maybe Lisa can send out a little reminder. Let us know those dates. Anything else?
No December meeting, no. I was incorrect. November and then January.
Oh, so we didn't have December. We didn't need December. Okay, that's fine. So we're not going to meet in December. We'll meet late January and then in February. Representative Driscoll.
Madam Chair, if we can just talk about the rest of the plan. We're getting the information. We're working on it. Will the commission have some working sessions to be able to then go through and kind of talk about what they would like to do and kind of debate amongst ourselves, since there's been such an onslaught of information?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, for sure. And that would probably be January and February.